The gurus are here. Alvin and Lawrence U. Bell, the gurus of How To, also known as Accurate Building Inspectors of Brooklyn, New York. So it's a pleasure to have them on the show.
It's a pleasure to see you, too, always.
And in your case, Alvin, you've been coming to the show even... You were coming to the show before I was here.
That's right. I remember that was with Marty Wayne. Mm-hmm. Marty Wayne, he was really a great guy and everything else. And when I first got on the show, he says, how could a home repair person be on radio? They got to be on television or something like that. And then all of a sudden he says, hey, come back again. And I've been here ever since.
And I'm always pleased to have the both of you here. We right now are finally entering into some warmer months or warmer days.
Summer, although today summer is cool on the horizon now. You know, it's right there.
Which means the usual stuff. I'm sure we'll be getting calls about air conditioning and the like and preparing for the summer.
Yes.
But is there anything you want to tell us before we get going with that?
Taking
calls at 212-433-9692?
Yes. Some of the people out there, you know, are having problems or having contractors do certain problems that really affect the legality of what the contractor is doing. I think...
Can you explain that?
Yeah, what we're finding now is that the biggest problem is that a person hires a contractor to put on a new roof. And they all say the roof has a 10-year or 20-year warranty. They pull the label off of the roofing material. They hand it to them and they say, here, this particular company, let's just say GAF, GAF, who makes roofing material, says it has a whatever warranty says on that particular thing. And the roofer puts the roof on, and lo and behold, a year or two later, the roof leaks. Can't find the contractor. They call up GAF, and they say, well, it says you have a 20-year warranty here. And they send a person down. They look at the roof, and they say, no, warranty is void because the contractor didn't install the roof as per our specifications. And they say, well, he didn't do it the way they're supposed to, so we're not guaranteeing the roof. And that is a very important part about the way a contractor installs a particular product, whether it's a roof, whether it's a heating equipment, air conditioning equipment, ventilator, oven, stove, whatever. You have to install it as per the manufacturer's specification. And the odd thing about that, which most people don't...
Well, how do you know whether the contractor is following those
specifications? Well, there's one way is, and unfortunately, it's not always viable to do this, but when people are doing large roof installations, or any really, you pay the company to come down and inspect the roof before you pay the contractor. And then they will give you a list of exceptions on the way the roof was installed. And then you hand it to your contractor and say, they don't like this, they don't like this, they don't like this, fix that. And then they fix those issues, and then they come out and inspect again. The problem is, for small roofing jobs, each time the company's not coming out to inspect for free, you have to pay them. And I'm not sure what that amount would be, but different companies have different fees. But that is the way to guarantee it. The last thing I want to say is that the interesting thing about it is that the manufacturer specifications become part of the building code for that particular product. So if that product is not installed as per manufacturer specifications, that particular part, let's say it's a heating system, isn't actually in violation of the code if they did not install it properly.
It's my sense, just based on my observations, that there's an awful lot of stuff that is not to code all over the city.
Really? Yeah. Shocking.
So what happens?
It is a problem.
You know, I almost feel like – you almost sound like the lieutenant in Casablanca. There's illegal stuff going on in here. Really?
But and Lawrence hits the nail right on the head. It goes to the point that even if you have an electrical panel box and the electrical panel box was made by GE and you use somebody else's circuit breaker to change it, right away the warranty is out the window. You cannot use different companies. You got to use the same company.
And it says right there on the panel that the panel and the breakers have to match. So people are doing improper stuff all the time. How do you know? And actually the best way to know is actually read all those installation instructions. And if something doesn't seem proper to you, bring it up to your contractor.
That's it. Right.
We're going to be taking some calls in just a moment. Our number is 212-433-9692. You can write to us on our show page at wnyc.org or on Facebook or Twitter, where our handle is at Leonard Lopate. You have brought a quiz.
Oh, I have a great word that we figured out.
A quiz.
Yeah, a quiz, yes. And could I do the honors?
Please, read
all
it.
All right, right.
People do know that they're supposed to call in with what they think the actual
answer the word is.
I'm not giving it to them.
Okay,
right.
Good.
All right. Painters and plasterers and masons have a hand tool that dates back a few centuries. It enables them to hold wet plaster, cement, and mortar in one hand while using a trowel with the other hand to apply the compound to a ceiling or wall. There is also a handle on the underside of this tool. What we're asking is the audience to name that tool.
Okay. And the number to call is 212-433-9692 if you know the answer. Let's take
They'll win something.
Yeah, sure. Well,
all
we'll
right.
Tell them what they win.
We've got to give them a little motivation out there.
Our first caller is John from Paramus. Hi, John. You're on the air.
What's up, John?
How you doing? You know, I think I saw Kirk Douglas use that tool in Spartacus. I don't know the name of it, though. But anyway, I just bought a brand new dehumidifier, and it works like a charm, but I get really tired of emptying it. Could I run a hose to my sump pump, and is that recommended? I'm afraid that the sump pump would be running too much.
No, you could definitely do that, and the amount of water is not going to have the sump pump running all the time. The thing I do recommend, and this is for anyone who has a sump pump, the sump pump pit itself, especially if there's water in it or it's wet, is another moisture source that is making your cellar or basement damp. So I definitely will encourage you to put a cover over that pit to keep the moisture in the pit. You don't want to create another moisture source in the basement. But yeah, you could definitely do that, and I highly recommend it, because the problem is if you have a dehumidifier, you have to constantly empty it. When you forget to empty it, then the humidity level goes right back up again.
Yes, but there's another thing about that. The humidifier should be a little bit higher off the floor than the pit of the drain, so the water goes by gravity. The other thing, what's good about that, is that you get the condensate into that pump. The pump will run every so often, which is a good thing, because if a pump doesn't run for some time, it suffers from like atrophy. It stops working altogether. So you get a benefit from that.
No, but I love that name, sump pump.
Yes.
Where does it come from?
It rhymes, sort of.
I think the area which it's in is called the sump. But the one thing I
and
want...
And the other one is called a pump, if you didn't know that.
But the other thing I want to say is that if you don't want to run it all the way to the sump pump, you can actually buy a condensate pump, which people use for air conditioning units, have that go into that pump, and have that pump the water wherever you want, whether it's into that pit, outside, or into a sink drain.
Yes.
Let's go now to Jan from Brooklyn. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi. I had a slob of a paint to paint my place this weekend, and he got paint on the floor, water soluble. I want something non-toxic to take it off.
Well,
the best time, of course, is when it's still wet. But
yes.
Once it dries, isn't it difficult to get off?
Yes, what happens if you take a plastic, they have what they call plastic spackling knives, mm-hmm, that are made out of plastic instead of metal. And those things, if you scrape that over that little spot, it'll pop the paint right
off.
And
also, if you warm it a little bit with a hairdryer, that will also soften up the paint so it will come off.
Excellent idea.
Okay, yeah. Jan?
And use water at the same time.
Yes.
Okay?
Okay, thank you.
No problem.
Michael from Manhattan, hi, you're on the air.
Hi. Lenny and
Larry
the
and
gurus.
Al. Yeah. Okay. Go on.
Listening, guys.
The guru is quite generic. Go ahead.
All right. I'll be brief. Just bought a place in a tower. It's got to be gutted. Any red flags besides the fact? I mean, I've already got the contractor.
You bought a place where?
It's in a tower unit. It's a high-rise.
A high-rise, okay.
Okay, and nothing but nightmares that everybody has told me. Gone over budget, this has happened, you have to pay off these people, et cetera, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
From your gentleman's experience, what is the number one red flag?
Well, it's not such a red flag. I find that when you get into a very large building where there is stationary engineers and everybody else, they have to make a living from what's going on in the building. And you're best off, if you figure it out, the elevator guy or a concierge will tell you who's running the building, and you go over to the building stationary engineer. He says, how do I go about doing it? and he will tell you all the things, troubles that he has had, and he may be able to help you with the appropriate contractor for that particular building. Mm-hmm. When you hire somebody else on the outside who's never been in that building, and all of a sudden they have problems getting into the elevator, they have a problem with this, they have a problem with that, and this is the best way to go.
Well, I think what Al was saying is that basically, if you use a contractor that the building management is familiar with, you might have less friction between the two, and it might work out better. It's not a guarantee, but because they have someone they like dealing with, as opposed to someone who thinks that they're, you know, that the building should give, you know, should lay down and die for them, and the building kind of puts up resistance, that could make your project go way longer.
Gotcha.
And take more time.
Right, I know you have a lot of people waiting.
Right. Yeah, but actually this problem concerns a lot of people, and whether it is a high-rise building or it's even just a 50-unit building or 25-unit building, there's still a super and a building management that you have to deal with. And if they like the contractor, they will be more amenable. If they don't like the contractor, they can make it a horror show. And so I think that is really what it comes down to.
Okay, Michael?
One more question.
Yeah, go ahead.
Follow up. Okay, mosquitoes. We have a nice place in Long Island, but we cannot enjoy it because the mosquitoes, now they've got these machines out there that are like $1,000, $2,000 a piece that, you know, suck in the mosquitoes. I don't know. Are these things worthwhile?
I think that I live in a lovely place called Staten Island, and that's our island bird. But at any rate, I tend to use more of the stuff where you spray the mist in your backyard for a while and it kind of keeps them at bay. You light the salmonella candles and you spray yourself with the DEEF, and that's kind of how I enjoy my backyard.
Actually, this coming Friday, we're going to be talking about mosquitoes on our Please Explain
segment. Oh, I'm going to be listening to that.
And we're going to find out whether any of those things work, including that thing.
Have a real good entomologist?
Yeah.
We're going to find out whether that thing that they sell in the New York Times for $179 is actually
any good. Well, I'm going to be listening, and let's cable this conversation until Friday.
Yes. There was one thing about this gentleman that you have to understand. There's a lot of things going on around the city. In fact, we have a couple of lawsuits that we're involved in as the experts to what should be going on.
You're testifying. You're not being sued.
Yeah. No, thank you very much. What happens is you got to understand people who are living in a metropolitan area like ourselves is that the building that you are in, even if it's a co-op or condo, the building really doesn't belong to you. That apartment doesn't belong to you. It belongs to the city of New York, and the taxes you pay is the rent. When you want to do something in your apartment, you got to tell the owner of the building or the management of the building, and you have to hire an architect. You cannot move a wall. You cannot do a lot of things. And what happens is you do something without the building department or without an architect, without an engineer, and without permission from the building. When you go to sell that apartment, you are going to have more trouble than you could shake a stick at.
Can you cause problems if you move a wall that...
Yes. The simple answer is just yes.
Yes.
I mean, the building, the ceiling can fall.
Yeah. You could do a lot of bad things. The simple answer is just say yes.
Yes. There's so much stuff in the walls, and you need an architect or engineer to and file it with the building department.
Yeah.
My guests are the gurus of how to, Al and Larry Ubell, Accurate Building Inspectors of Brooklyn, New York. And we are taking your calls at 212-433-9692. You could write to us on our show page at WNYC.org or on Facebook or Twitter, where our handle is at Leonard Lopate. And I have to tell you, this quiz was obviously too easy because every person who called in had the right answer.
You know, the funny thing was he said in the green room, he says, first guy is going to get this one.
And the first one to call.
First one.
Is Lou.
Hey, Lou.
From Stony Point. Hi, Lou.
Hi, guys.
What's it called?
It's called a hawk.
And not one person got it wrong.
Not one person got it wrong. And how did you know this, Lou?
I'm a contractor, and my friend is a very knowledgeable carpenter, and when he would come over to my house to help me with spackling repairs, he would bring the hawk, and it's kind of a funny name, so I always remembered it, and I actually called it a hawk.
And do you know why they call it a hawk?
I do not.
Because they got a handle on the bottom, and how would you hold a hawk? By its feet.
I guess so.
Okay.
I'm also a roofing contractor, and I was listening with great interest when you were explaining warranties.
Yeah.
Were you aware of that?
Oh, actually, just to tune up the information that your experts provided.
Yeah.
The manufacturer's warranty never warranties workmanship,
right,
unless your job is installed by an approved contractor who's approved by the manufacturer, mm-hmm, and you go through a process of paying for the warranty.
Mm-hmm.
And it's very difficult to get the manufacturer to come out and inspect, but they do it all the time for their approved contractors when mm-hmm you're selling, you know, the owner the high-end warranty. And it's a very good value. And at that point, when you get the high-end warranty, it covers the contractor's labor and the manufacturer's material. So there's nothing that escapes the warranty.
I thank you for that addition, and I and that all makes complete sense. But that really only happens with roofs that are over 10 or 20,000 square feet. No one's doing this for 1,000 to 4,000
square feet. So even though it's expensive, it could be expensive, it could be a lot more expensive if things go wrong.
Go on, Lou.
You can get it on residential. It's commercial warranties mm-hmm that have a minimum of 5,000 square feet.
Mm-hmm.
But there's many 1,200 square foot, 2,000 square foot residential roofs that have those warranties. In fact, the GAF warranty is known as the golden pledge.
Okay.
What does Lou win for getting the answer correct?
He gets a book that I wrote several years ago called The AluBel Energy Saving Guide for Homeowners. And you'll give your name and your address to the operator or the producer, and you'll have it in the mail.
Yes. So
thank you so much, Lou.
So
that
I'm putting
really
you on hold, Lou, and my producer will talk to you. And meanwhile, let's take another call. We go now to Ralph from Toms River. Hi, Ralph.
Hi there.
What's up?
I have a very complex situation with my home. I have, and I'll try to be as brief as possible. It's about a 30-year-old, two-story home. My floors, the upper floors are sagging terribly.
Mm-hmm.
I keep looking for evidence of cracking in the sheetrock and things like that. I don't see anything, so it leads me to believe that the house was rather poorly constructed, and I've gone along with stud finders, and mm-hmm I'm lucky if I hit anything when I'm trying to hang a picture or a shelf or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems like the sag is sort of mirrored in first floor, only in the kitchen. The other side of the house is fine. I've gone into my crawl space. I've measured my floor joists on the first floor. They should be 16 inches on center, and I'm lucky if they're 24.
Well, then, go ahead.
I guess the thing is, the only thing that leads me to believe is that I'm going to have to gut the house
mm-hmm
and put more 2x4s in, put more floor joists in. But is there any other solution barring that?
Well, I'm going to say that as far as wall joists, most likely you're not going to have to add more wall joists, because even with it being on 24 inches on center, if that's in fact what they did, you know, basically a wall is basically a really long column, and if it's still supporting the ceiling above it, that shouldn't be a problem. But as far as the floors are concerned, then you're probably going to have to add some joists, you know, in between, so making it more or less 12 inches on center, and you may end up having to put in, especially in your crawl space, an intermediate set of column and beam, or you know, a post and beam to support all that. And in the living room above, for the second floor, you may end up having to remove the drywall and doing a similar thing. It seems to me that if in fact the case that everything is 24 inches on center and most of these things are designed, we also don't even know the thickness of the joists themselves. Are they 2x6, 2x8, 2x10, 2x12, et cetera?
Right, yeah, that I understand.
Yeah, which is a big determining factor of its stiffness and rigidity. And so you would have to determine that. Obviously, this repair, I don't mean to sound like, you know, a broken ray, it's going to need the assistance of a structural engineer to give you a heads up on what you should do to correct this condition. But obviously, if this building's only 30 years old, I mean, my house is built in 1933, and my floors are as true and as square as can be. And so it's obviously that there was a failure or a problem during original construction.
But can I just ask this question?
Hang on a second.
Hang on.
Hold on.
he suggested that he might have to gut it. That seems like a more extreme
resolution. I'm kind of assuming that his term gut means removing the wall covering or the drywall. I have to say, as a person in the business, that removing drywall and putting it back is not a horrible problem for me, because drywall is quite inexpensive, and to remove it, throw it out, and buy new and put it in, especially since now that this drywall is all bent because of the sagging, is not a big deal. And yeah, the word gut kind of scares people, and I can understand that, but it's not as big a deal as one would be, especially to actually make these floors true and straight again.
Yeah,
but
now we have to go to a break. Do you want to say one other thing?
I'll come back after the break, and the people
okay.
I'll tell you what to do.
We'll be back with more from the Gurus of How To right after this. Our number 212-433-9692. You can write to us on our show page at WNYC.org or on Facebook or Twitter, where our handle is at Leonard Lopate. And we're back with the Gurus of How To, Al and Larry Ubell, also known as Accurate Building Inspectors of Brooklyn, New York. And Al, before we went to the break, you wanted to say something to the last caller.
Yeah, for those people who want to check the floor, if they're sagging or something like that, the best and easiest and inexpensive way of checking that is to take a string from one end of the room to the other end of the room and stretch it across the floor very tightly, and you can see if the thing sagged down. If it sags down like a half inch or a quarter of an inch or even 1 inch, it's not a big deal. If it's about 2 or 3 inches, then it becomes a big deal. And that's the cheapest and easiest way to check.
Julia from Chatham. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, guys. I've got a question for you. We just moved out of the city and bought a ranch, and the garage is located directly under the master bedroom. And mm-hmm. so we pulled up the carpet, and it doesn't have much insulation, and it sure was cold mm-hmm. last winter. So I was wondering what recommendations you could make.
I got a couple. One is to remove the drywall from the ceiling of the garage and insulate it. But before, what kind of heating system you have here?
It's furnace, so it's oil. It's gas heat.
Is it forced air? Or
yes.
So you really don't have. There's a couple. So you really don't have a radiant floor heat option. What I would do is pull down the drywall in the garage, and then what you could do is either get open or closed cell polyurethane sprayed to the floor underneath, and then put the drywall back. That will help insulate the floor. The closed-cell polyurethane I like a little better because it definitely closes up a lot of the gaps. It has a resistance to moisture penetration, or its permeability is very low, and it will keep the floor a little bit warmer. The other option, what's on the floor now? Carpeting or just hardwood?
Hardwood.
One of the things, obviously, is maybe an area rug in that area will also help it a lot. I had a similar problem in my kitchen. I just put down a tile floor, and the area underneath is my basement, so the floor was very uncomfortable with bare feet, actually painful. And I had the option, because I have hot water heat, to put radiant floor heating underneath it, and that's made it nice and toasty. But you can also, they do also make electric radiant heating pads, which you can also put down on the floor, but then you have to have a finish on top of that. You can't be walking right on that, but that could also be an option. But at least removing the drywall, insulating the ceiling of the garage, and then putting the drywall back is probably the easiest, cheapest way to try to keep it somewhat warm.
Okay, Julia?
Is that closed cell, is that sprayed in?
It's sprayed in.
Okay.
But it does, I have to tell you, it does outgas, and it outgasses quickly, but that garage will have to remain open for at least 24 hours, and you may not be able to come into the building for 24 hours. I think with the open cell, which is not as good, but it's still very good, it outgasses even quicker, but you can come in. I think you can actually be in the building, but you have to talk to your installer for those kind of precautions.
Virginia. Hi, Virginia from Englewood.
Hey, what's up?
Okay, we live in Maplewood, New Jersey. And,
oh, Maplewood.
We live on a slight incline of the street. We're on the downside of a hill. Mm-hmm. Every once in a while, and not on a regular basis, but only when there's been extreme storms, we get water in our basement. And we want to attack the problem. We've had several contractors come in, and everybody gives us a different answer. It's not enough that we want to go through a whole French drain build out, but it's enough to be bothersome. So a couple of people have suggested that we dig down in front of the house and expose the foundation and put a waterproof membrane on there and a kind of piping system in front of the house to catch the water before it comes in. Mm-hmm. And others have suggested that all we need is a sump pump in one corner of the basement and regrading the front so that it slopes away from the house. Mm-hmm. But there have been enough other options presented that I'm not quite sure of even the approach to take.
Well, by the way, before you get going, we have another call. I'm not going to put it on right now unless that caller feels that his question isn't answered. But he's also concerned about sealing off his basement because it's getting wet.
Okay.
Well, as far as... It depends upon how far away your house happens to be from the roadway or from the front or the street walk, wherever you have. And what is done is what's been done on many mountainous kinds of terrain is to dig out a gully around the building and then put perforated piping in this gully all the way around to draw it around to the lower end of the house behind the house and bring as much surface water away from the building. The idea is you should do this, not everything all at once, but do parts of it that seems obvious. Let's work on the obvious and then the inobvious later on. And that's the least expensive way. You do that with the drainage around the building and then take a wait-and-see attitude. Then you take it to the next step and the next step until you cure the problem.
But I want to ask one question. Does this flooding issue in the basement only happen in one area?
It primarily starts in one area. If it's really bad, it'll come up in other areas, but it seems to almost come up from underneath.
Right. So what's happening is regrading, and you don't see a whole lot of surface water coming across to your building, do you?
No, not at all.
Okay, so all this is happening substrata.
Hydrostatic pressure is coming
right
up.
And if it's coming up below from the floor itself, is this a rough basement or finished?
Part of it is finished.
Is the area where the water's coming in finished or rough?
Finished.
Unfortunately. So we really don't know how it's coming through the foundation because we can't really see the foundation, correct?
Right.
Okay, so one of the things I would actually start off with is I would go with the solution of just putting a sump pit and a sump pump in the one area where the water is the worst and see how that works.
Now, I have brought Chris from Seacliff on.
Hello, Chris.
Hello,
Chris from Seacliff.
Is your problem different?
Yes. Well, it's different because I have an unfinished basement, and my house was built in 1890.
Right.
So my foundation on one side of the basement is dramatically kind of deteriorated, and that seems to be where the water is coming through. But my question is, and I was suggested by a mason that I know to kind of resurface the foundation wall with cement and then spray it with a dry lock. My question is that going to do it? Because I want to refinish the basement.
Al, you're shaking your head. No.
We both are in the same opinion.
That will not work.
In a word, no.
It's a really no, but what has to be done on your instance is they're going to have to trench around the outside of the building and then cement podge the foundation, make it nice and smooth, and then put on some modified bituminous, like membrane waterproofing of the foundation around that section to hold it in. All that you're doing is, when you do it to the inside, is you're putting a finish on, and then the hydrostatic pressure will just push that material
right off the foundation.
But
I do want to ask a question to caller number two. Is that...
this is Chris.
Chris.
Virginia and Chris
Virginia
are both on the line.
Chris and Virginia. Chris, that the one thing that I'm... Yours is a stone foundation, I'm assuming, right?
Yeah.
And it's probably a lime mortar, so there's a lot of erosion.
Yes.
Yeah.
I live right by the ocean. It's all sand.
Yeah. One of the things I do recommend is that either on, just to stabilize this foundation, is either on the, because there's a lot of moisture coming through, so either on the outside, which is pretty costly to dig up and trench around the building, or on the inside, is to basically pour a new foundation next to your existing foundation to stabilize it. And therefore, this way you would actually have more, you would actually have, you know, high performance concrete there, as opposed to basically a stone and mortar fence. That's basically all your foundation is. And the fact that the water's coming through it, doing it on the outside like my father recommends would be great, because that way you can put membrane waterproofing on the outside and you have a good viable, and also with a drainage mat also attached to it, that would actually do the trick. As far as Virginia is concerned, like I said before, I think that putting a sump pump in the area where the flooding is the worst to start off with would probably be the most economical and maybe even the most viable solution and to alleviate that water, which only happens once in a while.
And the deeper that sump pump is in the ground, below that basement floor, the better it will work.
So if you can go down maybe a couple of feet, that would be great. And also at the bottom, I'm going to recommend this for all sump pumps, put marble chips at the bottom. It throws off the pH balance, and it stops the insects from growing in that area.
Let's take a call now from Clayto from Brooklyn. Hi, Clayto. You're on the air.
Hello, Clayto. Hello.
Hello, Clayto.
Okay.
We're on hold.
I'll put Clayto on hold. Maybe we can get him back because he has an interesting question. Kira on Facebook writes, I live in a 1920s era building about half a block from the BQE in Brooklyn. The building shakes significantly enough that you can feel it. Mm-hmm. Water in a glass moves at least a few times an hour all day and night. Are there any structural issues that might arise from this?
Well, next to the BQE, that's a very difficult thing to...
I think the short answer is yes, structural issues can come because of this vibration. But these structural issues will usually rear their ugly head in a very obvious way. So if you start getting cracking, whether it's on the inside of the inside plaster or drywall or on the outside masonry, if this is a masonry building, or even on the siding that the vinyl, aluminum, or wood siding is no longer parallel and seems wavy, then this is a telltale sign that you're.
And what might
issue.
Happen? The building fall?
Yes, actually, a masonry building, it could fall. Because remember, the thing about all these buildings that were built before the turn of the century, the only thing holding up these walls is gravity, and that's why they haven't moved. And so, any kind of lateral force applied to these walls could cause a failure.
The other thing they could look for is the doors, that all of a sudden doors don't stop fitting right. The miters in the corner start opening up, and that also is a telltale sign.
Sounds scary. Clayto, hi. You got to make it quick now.
Good afternoon, gentlemen.
What's up? Tell us.
Alas, I'm not a homeowner. I'm a renter. But I have what I think is a fairly easy question, but a mystery to me.
Go right ahead.
I have two 10,000 BTU air conditioners. Okay, one's in the front, one's in the back. I've had them maybe 10 or 15 years, maybe longer. I use them every year, 3 months straight, because I hate the humidity.
Right.
But the past couple of years, I've noticed that there's like this odd smell,
mm-hmm.
and I keep thinking about Legionnaire's disease and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
Can these be, or are they ever removed and power cleaned with a spray or anything like that?
Yeah, but I'm going to say that if this smell starts occurring, it could be that the air conditioner is not pitched properly and it's not draining completely, and therefore the water and your fear about Legionnaire's disease is a little warranted, that it's not pitching properly. The water is sitting at the bottom. Now, the water that comes out of an air conditioning unit is incredibly dirty. It has all the dirt and mold and everything that's in the air, but it's now in the water. And so you do have to make sure this drains properly. And also, how would you clean the bottom?
Well, all you need is some liquid detergent, a little chlorine bleach, and put it in the bottom of the tray or in the bottom of the thing. And that will kill any mildew or growth or anything that's nutrient away from the air conditioner.
But if the air conditioner is light enough to carry, can't you just take it out, put it in the tub, wash it, and then put it back?
Yes. That is really a viable thing if you can give it a good spritz and make it really work and clean it out, because they're designed to be thrown water at because they're out in the rain and there's also a lot of condensation. Mm. So if air conditioning works very well, and the old adage, cleanliness is next to godliness, and cleanliness is next to good operating air conditioning equipment.
Yeah, I didn't hear that part of that old saying.
No, it says that in the Bible. It really
does.
Yes,
it did. It does.
Well,
it's in Leviticus.
Some people will want to write to you, Larry.
Yes,
do they get to you?
The best way, it comes right to my phone. So email me at larryubell@gmail.com.
U-B-E-L-L. And include a phone number because...
Definitely include a phone number.
That way you can get back to them. And
if you don't include a phone number, you'll get another email saying, what's your phone number?
Meanwhile, we're going to have you back on August 13th. And what should the audience know about that?
We can show all of America again how to go forth and fix, save energy, money, and...
do it safely.